So just a little bit about the meeting I was in the Michigan area. This is close to the area where the Greers were from, who were part of us for some number of years, and not too far from where the Smelsers were from. In the Michigan area, the churches are few and far between up there. One of the Weisers is there, who many of you who are older remember Archie Weiser. He died in the late 90s. He was a member here in the 60s and in the 70s. And in the 80s, and died in the late 90s. And anyway, his son is one of the members there. But we take for granted the things we have in this part of the country, where we have gospel meetings all around, and Middle Tennessee, North Alabama, scattered through Kentucky. You can go to a meeting just about any time you want to, and preaching is so few and far between. The next nearest church would be at least an hour and a half away, and some of the churches in another direction are 3 hours away, and we'd have visitors come two and three nights and drive 3 hours one direction to come to the meeting because they hear very little preaching. And we take things for granted in our area. We need to be appreciative and take advantage of those opportunities. I want to raise a question for our study tonight, and that is the question of, do you ever feel like you live in a high-pressure world? Do you feel like that the world that you live in and the environment maybe is a little harder than what maybe your parents or grandparents faced? That you think, you know what, I wished I could have lived at a previous time because things are just so bad in this society that we live in. We live in a high-pressure world. And I don't think my granddaddy faced what we're facing today, you may think. And do you find it difficult to try to stay strong in that kind of environment that maybe if we could have lived in a previous time, maybe if I lived back in the 1800s, I just don't think it would be as hard to live because the challenges that we face today are more difficult maybe than they were a few years ago. And so can I live strong in the high-pressure world? Is it possible? Can it be done? Or is it asking the impossible to ask me to be strong when I live in an environment where the pressure is so strong? Is that impossible for me to do? And the question is, then, how can I stay strong in the midst of this high-pressure world? So tonight, we want to talk about standing strong in a high-pressure world. Four things I want us to consider about standing strong in a high-pressure world. We all have to admit we're living in a high-pressure world. The pressure is on from the world for us to live different than what God would have us to live. But how do you stand strong in the midst of a high-pressure world? Four things I want to consider. Number one, let's talk about the problem we're facing. Before we look at answers, we need to know what the problem is. And the problem is the pressure that the world puts on us, and how does it put that pressure upon us? Well, let's open our Bibles to 2 Timothy chapter 3, if you will. In 2 Timothy 3, I learned that a society of sin is a difficult circumstance for the people of God. So let's open our Bibles and spend a little time in 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 to 5 particularly, and we'll come back to some of the other context in a moment. But I want you to notice in verses 1 to 5, it is a description of a society of sin. This was true in Paul's time. That is, he is describing the society in which he lived. And actually, he's describing things that Timothy would face in the society in which he lived, which was the same society in which Paul lived. But it well could describe the society of 2017. And it is a society where there is sin that is rampant through society, and consequently, it puts high pressure upon those who are the people of God. We'll talk about the high pressure in a moment. So what we're noticing here is just basically an outline of verses 1 to 5. This is the characteristics of an ungodly world. And as we look at that, I want to think about what that does to us to live around this kind of environment. We'll come back to that second point in just a moment. But let's start beginning at verse 1. Know this, that in the last days perilous times will come. The last days describes not the very last period, just before, last few days before the second coming, as some of the millennialists and dispensationalists would argue, but it is talking about the last dispensation of time. This is the last days according to Peter in Acts chapter 2 beginning at verse 16. So we're now in the last days. So in the period of the last dispensation, here's how people are going to live. Here's what it's going to be like. Now notice at verse 2, and beginning following on the outline. They, first of all, people are going to live this way where they're giving emphasis on their self. In other words, they're selfish. They're lovers of themselves. Well, that's part of a characteristic of a sinful society where people don't think about other people. They're selfish and they only think about themselves. Well, secondly, notice they're greedy. They're lovers of money. I'm not going to spend the time developing each one of these in great detail. That's not my point. I want to just list the characteristics that make it a sinful society. Well, the next characteristic I notice is in verses 2 and 4. And there's three things that describe their arrogance. Notice it, verse 2. Verse 2 says they are boasters. Verse 2 also says they are proud. And in verse 4, they are haughty, or one translation says they're high-minded. Now, each one of those has a little different connotation, but they all describe a characteristic of arrogance. And so you look at your, maybe it's your neighbor, maybe it's a coworker, maybe it's someone in your family, that they're arrogant, they're high-minded, they're proud. They're arrogant people. That's part of a sinful society. Well, the next characteristic is they're disrespectful toward others in verses 2 and 3. Now, notice the six characteristics that show they don't really care about others. Now, why do they not care about others? Because they give emphasis to themselves and they're arrogant. They think so much about themselves. So they have no respect for other people. We live in a sinful society where, for example, people are, according to verse 2, they're blasphemers. They say things that are not true about other people, shows they have no respect. They're disobedient to the parents. Whether it's from the small child that doesn't understand what obedience is, or to that rebellious person that leaves home, they're disobedient to the parents. They don't have any respect for authority. They don't have any respect for leadership. Another principle, notice at verse 4, they're unthankful. They give no consideration to the things done for them, whether it's not being thankful to their home life, their parents, or to their friends, or maybe their co-workers who do for them. They're unthankful. They are not interested in thanking other people. They're false accusers, according to verse 3. Now, notice also verse 3, they're despisers of good, or that which is good, some translations say. Not only do they not do what's right, they have a despisal and a disregard for things or people that are good. Some think that expression talks about they're despising people that are good. They have no use for good people. Shows they're disrespectful. And furthermore, they're without natural affection. Natural affection is this affection that you would think that would come naturally, like a parent would have for a child. But you don't have to learn to love your child. You love them from the start, and that's natural affection. But here, they are without natural affection. They don't really care about other people. That's why we have abortion and euthanasia. Well, there's another characteristic. That is, they're unrestrained, verses 2, 3, and 4. They're incontinent. In other words, all of these, whether it's fierce or unholy or heady, all describes there is no restraint so that they do pretty much whatever they want to do. And they accomplish whatever they want to accomplish, and they seize whatever they want to seize, and they take whatever they want to take. They're not interested in other people. They're unrestrained. There is no boundary for them. Verses 3 and 4 show they can't be trusted. Notice verse 3, they're truce breakers. What does that mean? That means they violate what they said they would do. They make promises they don't fulfill. They're traitors, verse 4. They say one thing, they may do something else. They can't be trusted. And then you add to the fact, they're thrill seekers. They're lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God. They're more interested in doing something fun than they are in serving the Lord. That might involve sin. It might involve things that are not sinful, but that's more important than serving God. And then finally, they have this outward form of godliness. Even though inwardly they're full of themselves, there are many who put on a front of trying to be some kind of religious person or maybe some kind of respectable person, though deep down they're not. Now, I know that's a hurried look at verses 1 to 5, but what I want you to see is the idea that that's the characteristic, Paul said, of the society in which he lived. That well describes our own society. Now, the question is, what does that do for us? What does that do to us to live in that kind of society? Well, let's go back to verse 1. Paul said, the times are perilous. What does that mean? Perilous times. That is, when people live like this characteristics that we've just noticed here, he says, that makes the times perilous. Well, the American Standard says grievous times. New American Standard says difficult times. The New International says terrible times. The Revised Standard perhaps gets even closer to home here by saying it's times of stress. The English Standard says times of difficulty. Same word is translated fierce, Matthew 8 in verse 28. Now here's an interesting translation, the Living Bible, today's Living Bible. That you may well know this too, Timothy. Now this is a quotation from verse 1. You may know this too, Timothy, that in the last days it's going to be very difficult to be a Christian. Why is it going to be difficult to be a Christian? Because you're going to be living in a society full of sin, where people are giving emphasis to themselves, they're proud, they're arrogant, they're truce breakers, and you just name every one of those characteristics. The idea of it being perilous times, it's difficult for the Christian. Not just difficult times, but it's difficult for the Christian is the point. Listen to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. That perilous simply means difficult or embarrassing times in which it is difficult to know how to meet the danger, spiritual and temporal. Paul's warning young Timothy, Timothy, you're going to live when it's going to be hard and difficult to be a child of God. You're going to live in a high-pressure world, in other words. Matthew Henry said that sin makes the times perilous. When there is a general corruption of manners and the tempers of men, this makes times dangerous to live in. For it is hard to keep our integrity in the midst of general corruption. Translated says, the pressure is on in a high-pressure world to live a godly life. That's what this verse is saying. But a second thing, we're still talking about the pressure now. Here's the problem, the pressure of the world. The pressure of the world comes when we live in a society of sin, and that makes it difficult. But let's turn to Exodus 23 and in verse 2. The pressure is on when we are outnumbered. Notice the text in Exodus. Chapter 23 and in verse 2. The Lord through Moses said, you shall not follow the crowd, one translation, I believe the King James says, a multitude to do evil. Don't follow the crowd to do evil. What I'm learning from that is it's easy to do right when those around you are doing what's right. What if the only people you ever associated with were the people sitting right here in this midst, and it's easier to do what's right when everybody around you is doing what's right. It's easy to take a stand when those around you believe the same thing. Let's take a simple matter of abortion being sinful. It's easy to stand in a crowd like this and say, I believe abortion to be wrong. But what if you were the only one in the crowd and everybody else was a far-right liberal and you said, I believe abortion to be wrong? And they eat you alive, basically. That's not so easy anymore, is it? The pressure's on when you are outnumbered. It is different when most that you're with have, for example, different beliefs. They have different standards. When those around you have different morals, things are quite different than they were before. The pressure indeed is on. Now I want you to notice this passage in the book of Judges, if you will. The fear of the people easily causes people to have some pressure and begin perhaps to do some things that are wrong. There is pressure in numbers. Turn to the book of Judges, if you will. This is the case of Gideon, for example. God had told Gideon about his task, and he was much like Moses and kind of shrink back from that and didn't want to take the task. And he seems to be fearful and timid a little bit. But now notice at verse 27. So Gideon took men, 10 men from among the servants, and did as the Lord had told him. That sounds pretty good, doesn't it? I'm going to do just what God told me to do. But because he feared his father's household and the men of the city too much to do it by day, he did it by night. I want to do what the Lord said, but I don't want them to see me do that because I'm outnumbered. Case in point. Galatians 2. You remember how Peter had stood so strong that Gentiles are now gospel subjects. He defended that over at Jerusalem, Acts 11. And again in Acts 15, he strongly took a stand that Gentiles are gospel subjects. But now the time comes when some men came from James and he felt the pressure was on. He withdrew himself from the Gentiles, fearing those of the circumcision. They might put pressure on me. I don't want them to know I'm associating with Gentiles. Fear of people causes people to sin. To go with the numbers, to go with the crowds. Thirdly, We're still talking about the problem, the pressure of the world. A society of sin is difficult. The pressure is on when we're outnumbered. And then the world encourages us to be just like them. Turn to Proverbs 1. You are familiar with this text, no doubt. But in Proverbs chapter 1, the warning is, as a father giving instructions to his son, that if sinners entice you, do not consent. They encourage you to be just like them. What do they say? Well, they say things like, come, let us lie in wait, and let us shed blood, and let us lurk secretly for the innocent without a cause. Let us swallow them alive like Sheol, and whole like those who go down into the pit. We'll find all kinds of precious possessions. Cast your lot among us, verse 14, and let us have one purse. Come be one of the crowd. They persuade you to be just like them. Psalm 1 in verse 1 said, the ungodly give counsel. Do not walk in the counsel of the ungodly. What does that mean? That means people who are in sin give advice. People who do wrong will encourage you to do what they do. Don't listen to their advice. Don't listen to their encouragement. That's the point. They'll say things to you like, oh, come on and be a part of it. Why not do what we're doing? They may even beg you to do something. Remember the case of Potiphar's wife saying, come lie with me, she said. And she didn't do that one time, but she did that day by day, according to verse 10. They encourage you to be just like them. Still developing the idea of the problem. The pressure is on when the society is full of sin. That's difficult. When we're outnumbered. And when they encourage you to be just like them. And furthermore, pressure is on when they don't understand. Let's look at 1 Peter 4 and verse 4. Peter understood the nature of a high-pressure world. This is not new to our time. Even Moses understood that principle. In regard to these, he's just talked about living a life like the Gentiles, which we have wasted enough time living like the Gentiles. That's his point. In regard to these, they think it strange that you do not run with them to the same flood of dissipation, speaking evil of you. Paraphrase says they don't understand why you live like you live. They may make you feel odd. It may be some friend, maybe a co-worker, maybe a schoolmate. They don't understand. They make you feel odd. It may be someone in your family who makes you feel odd for the stand you take. You know, you're just kind of odd. That you believe what you believe and you act like you act. They may think you are the strange one and make you feel like you're strange. I'm not like everybody else. They may not comprehend the seriousness of whatever the issue or question may be. They're asking you to participate and you say no, and they don't understand why that's so serious for you. They don't understand the reasons you give. They may act as if you are extreme or maybe even silly. That you say, no, I can't do that. I can't go to that movie, or I can't participate in that action, or I won't drink any of that, or I don't even want to be with those who are drinking that. And they think you're extreme or you're silly, so they don't understand, and that puts the pressure on. So we're talking about this idea of the pressure being put on. Well, pressure is being put on when we're living where few Christians live. Now, we're fortunate, as I mentioned in my introduction, that we live where there are other Christians, not only in this congregation, but even in this town there are other congregations, and then surrounding towns there are other Christians. Think about living in an area where the church consists. I held a meeting one time where we had visitors the last night of the meeting. I was telling someone this morning about this. Where we had visitors the last night of the meeting, and we had to stand people up in the back of the auditorium because we didn't have enough seats for the 25 total people that we had. Not 25 visitors, that's the total crowd. And I can count about 8 of the people that we had brought with us. You think about worshiping in a place where that's all the Christians you have all around you for the next hour and a half drive, and you don't hardly have any Christians. The pressure's on when you live where very few Christians are. The pressure's on when you see sin at home and you're discouraged because of that. You see it in your parents, or you see it in your sibling, or you see it in your children, or maybe in your mate. The pressure is on when the work environment is such that you're surrounded by ungodly people. You go to work every day and everybody around you is ungodly. And the pressure's on when other Christians that you do know are not what they should be. And you wonder, how can I keep on in the high-pressure world? Let's talk about a second thing now. We've tried to describe the pressure of the world. That's the problem. Now, let's talk about the goal in the midst of that problem, and that's to stand strong. Stand strong in the midst of that. Let's turn to Romans 4. I don't know of a better example than to look at Abraham. A man of solid faith, strong faith. That's what I want in the midst of this high-pressure world. Well, let's see what we can find out about Abraham. We could say a great deal about Abraham. We're only going to get a glimpse of this beginning at verse 19. This is talking about God making the promise. He's going to have children. And what did he say about that? Or what was his response? And not being weak in faith, he did not consider his own body already dead, since he's about 100 years old, or the deadness of Sarah's womb. He did not waver at the promise of God through unbelief, but was strengthened in faith, giving glory to God, being fully convinced that what he has promised, he is also able to perform. What do I see in that? I see, first of all, he wasn't weak in faith. Strong faith Abraham had. He didn't waver at all. He didn't shake at all. Furthermore, he was strengthened, verse 20. Strong faith. In verse 21, he was fully convinced. He didn't kind of think, I believe God will do that. I kind of really think God's going to do that. He was fully convinced God would do it, despite all reasoning that might be given otherwise. And so the goal is, I want to stand strong and have the kind of faith that Abraham had. Here's another aspect of the goal. I want strong faith and solid faith. Secondly, concerning my goal, I want to be one that does not compromise. Be steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. Look at this word, unmovable. That means unshaken. That I can't be shaken, I can't be moved. When the winds are blowing, when the storm begins to howl, then I'm unmovable. I'm rooted. I'm grounded. I want to stand strong in the midst of the storm. I've always been fascinated with this statement in Exodus 10. Remember when Moses goes to Pharaoh and demands, let my people go. God says, let my people go. And Pharaoh tries to strike a compromise, and I'm fascinated with the statement that Moses made of our lives, that our livestock will go with us. Pharaoh wants to leave him to leave some of his livestock behind. Moses said, no, we're going to take our livestock with us, and notice his wording, not a hoof shall be left behind. We're not going to compromise at all. We're not going to compromise one hoof of one cow to leave behind. We're going to take every cow and every hoof with us. We're not going to leave a thing behind. We don't have one inch to give. The common thought is that if I could bend just a little, maybe the world will bend with me and they'll bend in my direction if I bend in theirs. The goal is to stand strong where there is no compromise. The goal is to have strong faith, an unwavering, no compromise spirit. And I want to worship regularly like we read in Hebrews 10 in verse 25, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as the manner of some is. That means I hardly ever miss. Hardly ever miss. That means that somebody knows something is wrong if I'm not there. And I want to tell you, as the elders, as we look at those who may miss from time to time, there are certain people when they miss, you know you better be calling immediately because something's wrong. They're not here. What's on? What's wrong? Does anybody know where they are? They should have been here. Where are they? Because they're always here. And I want to tell you, there's other people that when they miss, you don't immediately call because they missed the Sunday before and two Sundays before that, and they missed two Wednesdays before that because you just kind of expected them not to be here this time. That's not standing strong in the midst of an ungodly world. And when we worship faithfully, then we're worshiping from the heart, as John 4 and verse 24. Let's go to 2 Corinthians chapter 4 to continue that thought. In 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and in verse 1, this is a passage as you're turning there where Paul is basically saying, here's what makes me do what I do. I like to think of chapter 4 and 5, but particularly chapter 4, this is what makes me tick. Why I operate as I do? Paul, why do you do what you do? And why do you, when you're beaten, go back in the city and when they left you stoned for dead, you got up and went right back where they stoned you. Why would you do that? 2 Corinthians 4 gives us an answer to that. But in the midst of that, he says at verse 1 that we ought not to faint nor lose heart. Therefore, since we have this ministry, we have received mercy, we do not lose heart. We do not faint. Look at verse 16. Therefore, we do not lose heart. Now, I'm not going to go into the reasons why that's the case in the context, but his point is we don't lose heart. We're not easily discouraged. Because of the ministry that I've been given to, the responsibility I have before me, I do not easily get discouraged. I'm not ready to give up. And so what is the goal we have in the midst of this high-pressure world? The goal is I want to have a strong, solid faith. I want to be one who doesn't compromise. I want to be one who worships regularly, and I don't easily get discouraged. I'm standing strong in the midst of a high-pressure world. Thirdly, let's talk about the encouragement. I know what the problem is. I know what the goal is. I need encouragement in the midst of that. And encouragement comes from examples. What examples do for us, the examples serve as an encouragement that say it can be done. No one has to shout and say, look, I'm an example of it being done. The fact they're doing it says it can be done. Let's turn to Hebrews 11, if you will. We often talk about Hebrews 11 being a great passage that talks about, we call it Faith's Hall of Fame. And these are great examples of people who had faith. There's men like Abel and Enoch and Noah, and there's Abraham and there's Sarah, and there's Isaac and there's Jacob, and there's Moses and there's Rahab, and on down the line we go. And so in Hebrews chapter 11, these are great examples of faith. Chapter 12, verse 1. Chapter 12, verse 1. Therefore we also, what's the word also point to? In addition to these, we also... What does he say? Verse 1. We also, since we are surrounded by a great cloud of witness, let us lay aside every weight and sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. We've got a race to run in the midst of this high-pressure world. And I don't know if I can do it, but one of the things that's going to say I can do it is this cloud of witness, which is these examples. What is the cloud of witness? It's all of those people in chapter 11. And it's pictured as being in a race. And as you're about to run a race, you look to the stands and you see people who've already run. And they won their race. And if you're wondering, I don't know if I can make it all the way to the finish line, you see that one made it to the finish, and that one made it, and that one made it, and that one made it, and that one made it. That tells me I can too. Let's look at four such examples. Daniel. Let's go to the book of Daniel for a moment. And we will establish the fact, which is obvious if you have even a smattering knowledge of the book of Daniel, which you do, I know. You know that Daniel was a man who was under pressure. Evidence, he was taken into captivity. He was one of the first ones to be taken into captivity. He's under Babylonian rule. Stays there the whole time. And what I want you to notice is that yet while under that pressure, here's what he did. He refused to defile himself. He didn't give in to the pressure. You want to talk about living where everybody else around you is doing different and have different standards? Look at chapter 1, verses 8 and 9. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the king's delicacies. I'm not going to eat what everybody else is eating. Now, he's not surrounded by everybody who's eating like him. I mean, there's one person putting pressure on. He's surrounded by everybody else being different from him. Second occasion, chapter 6. There was a decree given that if anyone bowed down to any other god or any other being or any other image than Nebuchadnezzar, or rather, Darius the king, let him be cast into the fiery furnace. Look at verse 10. Daniel knew that the writing was signed. He knows the pressure. And he went to his upper room, he opened the window toward Jerusalem and knelt down and on his knees, and three times that day he prayed and gave thanks to God, as was his custom since the early days. He did not bow to the pressure. That encourages me to see a man like Daniel says, I can live in the midst of a high-pressure world. You want to talk about high pressure? Live in captivity under Babylonian rule. Let's notice another example. Joseph. Joseph was under pressure. Evidence he was under pressure? Let's go back to Genesis 37. I won't take the time to trace every one of these references, but if you want to turn to Genesis 37, let's make a quick run through Genesis 37, and I want you to see the pressure that he was under. Verse 4, his brothers hated him. Verse 2, it said he was the favored son of Jacob. They wanted to kill him, but they were stopped by Reuben, according to verses 18 to 22. They took his coat and cast him into a pit and sold him. Talk about being under pressure. Has that ever been done to you? His brothers early had made fun of him prior to that taking place, verse 19. The Midianites, to whom they sold him, took him off to Potiphar and sold him to Potiphar. Potiphar's wife tempted him and repeatedly on a daily basis said, "Come lie with me." And he refused. She lied about it. Remember, she basically said, "He tried to rape me." Because of that lie, he was cast into prison for something he didn't do. You're talking about high pressure? Look at Joseph. He was forgotten by the butler. But I want to talk about yet, in spite of that, he refused to yield to the temptation. Go back to Genesis 39. Are you at Genesis 39? If you're at 37, go two chapters later. Look at verse 8. But he refused, the text said. He's in Egypt, where most of the men would have done the very thing she was begging to do. There were many who would have given their eye teeth to be in his position of being tempted like he was. But he refused, the text said. Look at verse 12. That he fled and he ran outside. He refused to yield to the temptation. Look at chapter 42 and in verse 18. He maintained his fear of God. He told his brothers when they came to him that "I fear God," he said. There's something else he did in the midst of that. He looked for good in a bad situation. Though he was under high pressure, he said, "You meant it to me for evil. What you did to me, selling me and treating me the way you did, lying about me and all the bad things you did. But God meant it for good. God's using me for the good." He looked for some good in a bad situation. That encourages me. Here's another case. Moses, for example. Moses was under pressure. I don't know if he's under pressure. He was raised in Egypt. Ungodly Egypt, where there are many gods, as we talked about in Bible class this morning. The many gods they had. 2,000 such gods they had. Idolatry rampant. Ungodliness all around. He was raised as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. You talk about high pressure. He lived in a high pressure world. And yet, notice Hebrews chapter 11. Let's turn to Hebrews 11. Notice it, verse 27. In the midst of all of that, Hebrews 11, beginning at verse 27, by faith Moses forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for endured as seeing him who is invisible. He maintained his faith in the midst of a high-pressure world. Look at verse 28. He held to the precepts of God. By faith he kept the Passover. Now he's in Egypt. He's not surrounded by a bunch of the Israelites. He kept the Passover. Look at verse 24 and 25. He watched his association. He refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God. Furthermore, look at verse 25. He understood sin wasn't worth it because it was the passing pleasures of sin. He resisted the temptations in the midst of a high-pressure world. Let's notice a third example. And this is the case of Eunice. This is the mother of our great Timothy we read about in 1 and 2 Timothy. Why do we say she was under pressure? Well, she had an unbelieving mate. Timothy's father was not a Christian. He was not a believer. He was not even a Jewish believer. He was a Greek, the text tells us, Acts 16 and 1. But his mother was a faithful Jew, and so was his grandmother. Now, you want to talk about pressure? She has this pressure of an unbelieving mate. She has no help at home in raising her son in godliness. She has no encouragement at home from someone who understands the scriptures she's trying to teach to her son. She has no help. Some of you can identify with that. And yet in 2 Timothy chapter 2 and in verse 1 and verse 5, rather, I want you to notice that he had genuine faith. She had genuine faith that she instilled in Timothy. The genuine faith that first dwelt in your mother, your grandmother, and your mother, and as in you also, Paul told Timothy. Even though she didn't have support at home, even though she had the discouragement of an unbelieving mate, she had genuine faith. She taught her son. Timothy was taught the scriptures, which you have known since childhood, since he was a toddler, a babe. the idea of one who's old enough to walk around and comprehend. Since you were that little child running around, you've known the Holy Scriptures. She knew them well enough to teach them to her son. And so here are these examples, whether it be Daniel, Joseph, Moses, or Eunice. That's an encouragement that says, you know what? If they did it in the midst of a high-pressure world, you can too. Now, here's the last thing, and the lesson will be yours. Let's talk about the answer. We've looked at the problem, the pressure of the world. We looked at the goal is to stand strong. The encouragement are the examples. But the answer to living that is, how do you do that? What do I do? How do I do it? Is it something complicated that I've got to try to figure out? What do I do? The answer is quite simple. Just follow the Scriptures. Number one, here's some things that contribute to your spiritual strength. Number one, spend some time studying the Scriptures. Now remember, we've got to have faith in the midst of this. Abraham had strong faith. Faith cometh by hearing, and hearing by the Word. So if I'm going to have faith, then my faith's going to be strong. I've got to spend some time with the Word then. That's what I'm going to have to do. And so faith comes by hearing, hearing by the Word. Paul said, I commend you to the Word of His grace. This is Acts 20 and verse 32, which is able to build you up. You say, I need to be built up so I can be strong. Well, then spend some time with the Word of His grace. That's how you do it. The Bereans were a noble example of that in Acts 17 and verse 11. They searched the Scriptures daily whether the things were so. They spent time every day with the Scriptures. I think you'll find if you make it a practice that you ask those who become wayward, are you still studying the Scriptures like you used to? They'll all say, well, I don't study like I used to. Has something to do with standing strong. Here's a second thing. Pray. Paul told Timothy, Paul wrote to the Thessalonians rather, 1 Thessalonians 5:17, pray without ceasing. Jesus spoke a parable to this end, Luke 18 and verse 1. Men ought always to pray and not to faint, not to become discouraged. When people come discouraged, they quit praying. They don't see a need for praying. They don't see a reason for praying. But men ought always to pray and not to faint. If you make it a practice of talking to people who become weak and they become wayward and finally they drift away, you ask them, do you still pray as strong and as fervent as you used to? They'll all say, no, I don't pray like I used to. Those two things must be some key to being strong in the midst of a high-pressure world. They must be. Here's the third thing. Attend. What does that have to do with anything? Well, let's go back to Hebrews 10. Look at verse 24. Let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works. See, I want to be strong in a high-pressure world. I need somebody to help stir me up. I wish somebody would help stir up my love and good works. You notice what the next verse says? Not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as a manner of some is. Assembling with the saints is designed, if we're doing what we should, stirring up love and good works. It's part of staying strong. Fourth, be diligent. Giving all diligence, add to your faith, virtue to virtue, knowledge. What's diligence? It means do your best. Put every effort into it. Are you doing your best? You say, I want to stand strong in a high-pressure world because I'm surrounded by so much ungodliness and I get so discouraged. I don't know if I can do it. Then do the best you can. Get every aspect of Christianity. Do the best you can. Say more about that in a moment. Fear God. Make sure you have the fear of God in your heart. The kind of the fear that is described in those twin Psalms, Psalm 33 and Psalm 34. Those two psalms talk about the fear of God. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. Psalm 34 and verse 11. The kind of fear of God that is described as being the righteous. By the way, Psalm 34 is quoted in 1 Peter 3:12. The eyes of the Lord are over the righteous, and His ears are open to their prayers. Those that are called the righteous, that's quoted from Psalm 34, which is a psalm about the fear of God. It's another way of saying being righteous before God. Ecclesiastes 12:13 says that the whole purpose and duty of man is to fear God and keep His commandments. Here's something else. Deny ungodliness. What does that mean? Say no to it. Say, no, I'm not going. Remember the case of Joseph. Joseph refused, the text says. He refused. Say no to ungodliness. denying ungodliness and worldly lust. That's what the grace of God teaches us, Titus 2 and in verse 12. Mark 8 and verse 34, Jesus said, and I'm going to paraphrase, if you want to be my follower and be my disciple, you need to learn this principle of denying yourself, saying no to some things that you may really want to do. When there are things I want to do, and yet even though it may be contrary to the will of God, I'm still going to do them anyway, then I haven't practiced self-denial. I want to stand strong. I got to practice denying self, denying ungodliness. Work toward growth. I said we'd come back to this passage. Let's go to 2 Peter chapter 1, beginning at verse 5. Add to your faith virtue, giving all diligence. Add to your faith virtue, to virtue knowledge, knowledge temperance. You know the passage. It talks about the characteristics we call the Christian graces. So you take the foundation of faith and you build upon that and you add to your faith virtue and you take that and you add to that to virtue knowledge and knowledge temperance and on down the line. It's the idea of growing, giving all diligence, doing the best you can in every one of those characteristics. Let's take the matter of love. You say, I think I love people, but can you grow and increase your love even more? Can you take knowledge and increase even more? Can you take your endurance, which is patience, and increase even more? And so the idea of diligence that we just talked about a moment ago is the idea of being diligent in the areas wherein I need to be growing. Are you growing? Are you trying to increase? Or do you feel like you're on a level plane where you've leveled off? You want to stand strong in a high-pressure world? We need to be growing, as 2 Peter chapter 1. I want you to turn there with me if you've already left that passage, or maybe you're still there. Because I want you to notice this in 2 Peter chapter 1. He said, for he who lacks, I'm reading now at verse 9, for he who lacks these things, let me back up to verse 8. For if these things are yours and abound, then you'll be neither barren nor unfruitful in the knowledge. That sounds like you're standing strong in a high-pressure world, doesn't it? Look at verse 9. For he who lacks these things is short-sighted, even the blindness, and forgotten that he's purged from his old sin. Sounds like he's not standing strong in a high-pressure world. Verse 10. Therefore, be even more diligent to make your calling and election sure. Sounds like standing strong in the midst of a high-pressure world. For if you do these things, you will never stumble. That sounds like standing strong in a high-pressure world, doesn't it? Next, examine yourself. Paul said, examine yourselves whether you're in the faith. By the way, that was in a context of him writing to the church at Corinth, saying, in essence, that I'm going to come to you, and when I come to you, what I do when I get there, whether it's a rebuke that is severe or it is a commendation to you, has everything to do with how you're living. So in the meantime, what you do is examine yourselves to see if you're doing what's right. That's his point. You say, I want to be strong in a high-pressure world. Then examine yourself and see how strong you are now. Do a good self-examination in the midst of that. Therefore, Hebrews 2 and in verse 1 says, we ought to give the more earnest heed to the things that we have heard. Why? Lest at any time we should drift away. In other words, you've already heard the message. That's not the question. You've already heard the message. So give the more earnest heed to that, lest you let it drift away from you. In other words, think about application to yourself. You already know it. The problem is whether we're going to make application about that. I think that's the whole principle of James 1 and verse 22. Be ye doers of the word, not hearers only. For hearers only, we're not making application to ourselves. And then focus on eternity, finally. Get your mind focused on eternity. Colossians 3 and in verse 2 says, set your mind on things that are above. Rather than focus on the here and the now and everything all around you, focus on things that are above, things that have to do with eternity. But I'm most interested at this juncture with Hebrews 12, 13 and verse 14, for here have we no continuing city, but we seek one to come. In other words, we look around and say, you know what, this is not all there is. This is not all that's about. This is no abiding city. We're looking for something that is yet to come, something far more permanent. So how do I do it? Spend time studying. Spend time praying. Come to all the assemblies. Be diligent. Maintain your fear of God. Deny ungodliness. Work toward growth. Examine yourself. Make application to yourself. Focus on eternity. And you're going to be strong in the midst of a high-pressure world. The problem is the pressure of the world. The goal is to stand strong. The encouragement comes from examples. The answer is how we do it that is found revealed in the Scripture, standing strong in a high-pressure world. There may be one or more present who's not a Christian, who's not a child of God. Would you come believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Would you repent of your sins? Would you acknowledge your faith? And be buried in the waters of baptism for the remission of sins. If you're subject in any way, would you come all together? We stand and sing.